friends, it's me, McCall, with another episode of Unboxing God.
For almost 40 years now, I've been saying the Serenity Prayer, asking God for serenity, courage, and wisdom. But for almost 40 years now, I've also cringed a bit every time I say the word serenity. See, serenity's a word much like God that gave me enough reaction to not really want to deal with the challenge. I allowed my inner punk rock child to determine my love of excitement and chaos. I want the drama without the anger or fears or tears. But what does that look like? In fact, if we took all the negative emotions out of chaos and yet left the excitement, would it even remain chaos? Or would it actually just be lame old satisfaction, contentment, peace, and serenity? To be happy, do I have to be still and bored? Where's all my natural McCall energy gonna go? Does that just disappear? Would I become a new and different McCall? Should I actually become calm and content and serene? Would I be doomed to be a yoga teacher and wear patchouli and drink kombucha? Or is there, as I am convinced there always is, a third option? Well, for so long I was preoccupied with the past and obsessed with the future. Anything but this moment, because now always felt so unbearable. I longed for what psychologist Carl Rogers called a rich, full, and exciting life. He describes the life of the fully functioning, well-adjusted, mature individual as rich, full, and exciting, and suggests that they experience joy and pain, love and heartbreak, fear and courage more intensely. Well, I relate to intensely. Here's what Rogers actually wrote in 1961. This process of the good life is not, I am convinced, a life for the faint-hearted. It involves the stretching and growing of becoming more and more of one's potentialities. It involves the courage to be. It means launching oneself fully into the stream of life.
In his philosophical treatise, The Passions of the Soul, Descartes defines and investigates what he calls the six primary passions: love, hate, joy, sadness, desire, and wonder. Well, I have always had a lot of desires, wants, even needs in my mind. And if I wasn't being fueled by anger, I was juiced by hate. And there was grief, that Eeyore-esque sadness that became my constant companion from time to time. But I knew joy, too, even though it was a dangerous feeling, because of its fleeting nature and the anger and sadness that seemed to fill the space that joy would inevitably leave behind in its wake. But wonder? I don't remember a lot of wonder as a child, and I had little ability to indulge in wonder when I was young. That's why today I want to turn my attention to wonder, and more specifically to awe, to see what I missed out on, and how I can make up for lost time. Throughout the episode, you'll be hearing from various researchers and scientists. If you want to check out exactly who they are and learn more about their research, just head over to unboxinggodpodcast.com. There's complete show notes, including links and all kinds of other resources. Now, on with the show. I suspect that growing up as the only child of a single mom with alcoholism, a disease that's even more baffling, powerful, and cunning than either of us were, created some need in me to grow up quickly, to outgrow the childlike wonder and awe that's afforded to normal kids, the ones who don't have to navigate between two shores of a parent's sobriety and intoxication, who didn't require hypervigilance to remain safe, or else had to drop the adult role to allow her mom to parent when she was able. I mean, how could I take the time to experience wonder or be in awe when I was constantly on guard? But I will also admit that when I finally did indulge in my experiments with wonder, now as an adult, I found that awe and wonder might be yet a few more things that are wasted on the young. Awe is the feeling of being in the presence of something vast that challenges your understanding of the world.
The feeling of being around vast things that transcend your understanding.
It's unlike many of its related emotional states. Astonishment, less intense. Beholding beauty, that's less powerful. We differentiate awe from elevation, where you feel inspired by the moral goodness of other people, and from epiphanies, which are sudden realizations of things really deep and meaningful about your life and the world. Epiphanies aren't necessarily vast, like awe is. And wonder, well, that's close, but no cigar. Wonder's more of a knowledge-seeking state. It's the state of curiosity and amazement that motivates a search for understanding.
First, we dove into what kind of outcomes do you get when you feel awe? What do you find? Then we actually took, I think, a few steps back and tried to figure out, actually, what is this emotion? We don't even know. We have trouble classifying it as positive or negative, right? It defies some of these emotion theories that we have.
Awe, like any other human emotion, has a rich and interesting cultural history, so to speak. In the earliest days of recorded human history, awe went hand in hand with religious experience. It was filled with dread and wonder and uncertainty and deep humility. Because that's how, thousands of years ago, people expressed awe when they wrote of encountering God. The idea of awe kind of transformed during the Enlightenment of the 18th century, however, when it was suggested that awe arises when, quote, perceiving power that's obscure. For instance, when we saw thunder or lightning in the sky, the stars. As a result, awe was taken out of the purely religious realm and brought into our everyday perceptual experience.
The field really kicked off in 2003 when a group of researchers published a study in cognition and emotion where they first proposed the idea of awe as a way of processing something that seems too vast to comprehend. They also came up with five so-called flavors that might affect our sense of awe: threat, beauty, ability, virtue, and a sense of the supernatural. Including threat in that list might be surprising at first because people don't talk about awe as a negative thing or a sign of a threat, but it can be. The word awe actually comes from the Middle English words for fear, dread, and terror. And good and bad awe are both parts of the English language today. It's what the words awesome and awful have in common. Negative awe is the type of feeling you might get from looking at pictures of horrible destruction after a hurricane or an earthquake. It's definitely not in the same category as sequoias and rainbows, but it's hard to wrap your head around in a similar way. But whether the feeling is positive or negative, the evolutionary roots of awe can tell you a lot about why we experience it in the first place. Like a lot of emotions, it all comes down to how social we are as a species. In that 2003 paper about the flavors of awe, the researchers also proposed that the feeling evolved as a way for underlings to react to a powerful leader. That might seem kind of unsettling these days because we've seen fascism and we all know how that goes. But fear and submission in the face of powerful group members are actually common in lots of primates, and back in the day, it was the simplest way to avoid conflict.
If you've listened to any of the earlier UBG episodes, you already know that psychologist William James published The Varieties of Religious Experience in the early 1800s. It's the book that sort of got me started on this whole journey towards Waldo. For the lectures that book is based on, William James rooted out the mystical core to all experiences of awe, regardless of culture or faith. He surveyed Puritan preachers and Buddhists, Hindus, old and young, extroverts and introverts, the religious and non. And his results were consistent across things like visions or enlightenment, transitional states. And here is what they all have in common. The essence, in effect, of awe is, number one, you lose the sense of the boundaries between self and other. Number two, you lose sense of time. And number three, you feel deeply interconnected. I think this is the perfect opportunity to drop a name, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who, of course, I adore because of his name, also his words, but almost anybody would consider Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of America's greatest writers. He was part of the Transcendentalist movement and a fierce advocate for nature as a source of awe.
Here's one of my favorite quotes on all by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Out in nature, we return to reason and faith. There's nothing that can befall me. All mean egotism vanishes.
He championed getting out of ourselves by getting into nature.
1 minute of being outdoors led people to feel less entitled, less narcissistic. They needed less money to do the study.
Because when we experience nature, our sense of self begins to fade into the whole. Time stops, and there's this shrinking of ourselves, along with the more egotistical concerns of our lives. But simultaneously, we feel an expansion of who we are and how we're connected. Yeah, William James nailed it in 1802. Researchers surveyed thousands of people in 26 different countries and asked them to write about their experiences of awe. They found out that the most common source of awe worldwide is actually other people. Specifically, they discovered that we are awestruck by other people's kindness. Also their virtuosity, like if you hear a kid play the piano magnificently, you could be awestruck by how good they are. We're awestruck by people's heroism. For example, people who overcome challenging life circumstances and go on to do good for the rest of the world. Unexpectedly, those same researchers found that childbirth was also a common source of awe across all the countries. You know, the spectacular aspects of the whole thing and the fact that life comes out of it. The second most common source of awe is nature. We're awestruck by sunsets and waves, trees and vistas, tornadoes, all sorts of natural Fibonacci spiral patterns. The third most common source of awe is spirituality that can be found in prayer and contemplation, not necessarily religious ritual. That same sort of awe is also inspired by art, music, paintings, even architecture. We're also awestruck by size, both great and small. We are equally filled with awe when standing next to an enormous skyscraper as we are when peering through a microscope at the smallest bacteria. Research has consistently shown this amazing experience of awe does a few important things. It helps us form strong social groups. It shifts our attention away from our own self-interest to focus on other people's interests. It also helps us form ultra-social groups by motivating and producing more altruistic and cooperative behavior, which is a foundation of human social living. In a study conducted over 2 weeks in China and the United States, there was one group of participants that was asked to write every night about whether they experienced awe that day, and another group asked to write about whether they experienced another positive emotion, joy. Well, researchers found that if participants had experienced awe during that day, their sense of self was smaller than the sense of self of the participants in the joy group. Research shows that as people's sense of self becomes smaller and starts to vanish, they're aware of much stronger connections that they have to other people in their social network.
It promotes prosociality as part of, I think, that self-transcendent element where you're focusing more outward on others and what other people need. A sense of interconnection, common humanity, interest in things that affect all humans because you feel more connected to other people out there in the world. There's been arguments put forward that it promotes this sort of strong group orientation and identification with a group. And I think that could be a really fruitful direction for research, both in a potentially good direction, but also maybe a dangerous direction. Mm-hmm. If you think about the antecedents of cults,
yeah,
and some of that
behavior. Leaders.
Charismatic leaders. Yeah. So it does seem to be associated with these self-transcendent pro-social outcomes, which is why I typically put it in that category of emotions.
Another benefit to the diminishing or vanishing even of self is the ethic of humility. Humility has two different attributes. First, you have a realistic view of yourself, including your faults, and you're open to the strengths of other people. Many studies show that the momentary experiences of awe make people humbler, and that helps us fold into the social collectives we're a part of. As self-focus fades, we become more curious about other people. Research shows that when people feel awe, they ask more questions of other people during social interactions, and we seek out more social interactions. Plus, those same studies show that we have an expanded sense of time during said interactions. Another benefit? We feel less everyday stress. As we feel awe and experience less self-focus, the body's stress-related inflammation responses, like the ones that produce cells which attack pathogens in your body, and can be super problematic when they're chronically activated, as I learned in our episode on trauma and epigenetics. Well, awe lowers body inflammation.
In my lab, we've been interested in the health benefits of awe, and what we find is that regular experiences of awe and wonder and reverence quiet the body's inflammation response. It's produced by the cytokine system. It produces flu-like symptoms. It's a pathway to heart disease and diabetes. When chronically activated, awe quiets that response.
So we're more connected, less selfish, more cooperative, we share more, sacrifice for others, and are kinder. Plus, our bodies are less inflamed.
But that being said, it has really fascinating cognitive outcomes as well.
The research that I've done related to awe looks at its relationship to feelings of uncertainty, inability to explain what you're experiencing, and the motivations to explain and to find meaning that experience can evoke. So, for example, we find that when you have people watch video clips that elicits awe, they report lower tolerance for uncertainty. And this in turn motivates them to report greater belief in supernatural agencies. So belief in God, belief in supernatural forces like karma. We also find that this effect depends a bit on the theism of our participants. If you're a theist, then awe has a direct effect on your strength of belief in the power of supernatural entities. We have some evidence that suggests for non-theists, it increases your affinity for scientific explanations for the world.
That makes me wonder, how does one go about experiencing more awe? Like, what rocks do I turn over to inspire wonder? One of the problems I've always had with religions is I feel like they discourage doubt, as if questions might be somehow threatening. When someone discourages my doubt strongly increases. But I have found if I turn doubt into that understanding-seeking version of awe called wonder, that tends to lead straight towards my bliss. How often do we all just do the usual routine? The vast majority of our time is spent on the usual. We function on autopilot almost all of the time. But the usual is really just a filler of that empty space. We came into this life to experience, to grow in consciousness, to expand, to evolve. Doing the usual is not what makes us grow. True aliveness is doing the unusual, trying something new, acting on intuition, thinking new, looking at things in a new way, changing our approach, and not taking things for granted.
even perceiving those things that we do time and time again, as if it was the very first time. To do the same thing again for the first time. To do the unusual.
Last week, I spoke with a new friend, Michael Richardson. He's a professor of child development and classroom management at Brigham Young University, and he's Mormon. We crossed paths in a philosophy and religion Facebook group, and I admire him a great deal. You teach college, yeah? You're at BYU?
Yeah, I teach adolescent development and classroom management for future junior high and high school teachers.
My last two episodes are basically going on a journey from encouraging doubt instead of clarity, which is an enemy of knowledge, as Don Juan said.
Clarity is?
Yeah. Clarity is one of the four enemies of knowledge. As soon as you're sure, you stop looking. And in relation to, quote, God, if God is the end all be all truth, with a capital T, there's no path of searching that isn't going to lead you to it. Mm-hmm. We're given an intuition as a connection to a higher power, but that doubt, you shouldn't be frightened by it. You should be encouraged to turn it to wonder, which is seeking. Then wonder turns to awe. If you're in the moment and you're witness to creation, doesn't matter if it's God's creation, a human being's idea, a technological advance, a vista of a mountain, awe connects us to other people, but also humbles us. It shrinks us down and yet lifts us up as part of connected fabric of everything. So we become minuscule and epic at the same time. And according to science, time changes. You experience time differently in awe. I'm all about the Joseph Campbell idea of finding and following bliss. True bliss doesn't harm others or yourself. Another quality of awe and bliss is it helps connect human beings. Darwin's idea of social fabric, the connection of putting a community above yourself, self-interest, and that awe inspires that kind of behavior.
Yeah, I love what you're saying. And I love what you said about doubt and wonder and awe, because in my view, doubt can be dangerous. You can get lost in doubt and you can get lost in certainty. I love that because it reminded me of this Little Gideon by T.S. Eliot. And he says, with the drawing of this love and the voice of this calling, we shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And then he says, through the unknown, unremembered gate. So we go on this individualistic journey to find ourselves. And the end of all this exploring is to come back home and recognize home, this community, for the first time, see it for the first time. And we come through this gate, this unremembered gate. We've been there before, but often we forget. Isn't that interesting?
Even crazier, my definition of awe is experiencing something for the first time again.
Wow, I like that.
It comes from Jason Silva.
For the first time again.
It's childlike. It's wonder. It's getting on your stomach and looking at the ants and seeing awe instead of rushing to work and just stepping on them and never even considering they're there.
Yeah. Back to the Christian story. We start out in this garden, right? This place. We're with God and everything is perfect and blissful. And this is one thing that separates theology from my church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, from some other Christians. The fall is seen as, in a lot of views, as a tragedy. In our view, it was seen as necessary. It wasn't something God wanted to impose upon us because he's the source of good, but he
allows.
Yes, he allowed. He put the tree there and he says,
let there be good and evil. Like, let there be light.
And you can choose it, but you're going to die. But we will send a redeemer to bring you back and save you after you've learned from your own experience. But you have to learn the difference between good and evil if you want to really understand what it means to be home, what it means to be here in heaven. And so we go out into the world. And this is the story throughout all of Christian scripture for me, the scattering of Israel and then gathering them back. The prodigal son goes out and then he's welcomed back home. After he comes to himself, he knows himself. And Adam and Eve, they've fallen and they're redeemed. And it's interesting to me that this story of this journey, it's a circle. We talk about in our religion, God's course is one eternal round. We go away from home, we come back home. But what does Christ say? He says, you go out and you become on your own. And the way to get back, he says, the way to get home is to become as a child. You want to get into heaven. That's what's made up of children. But how do you do that? How do you go out and become an adult and have the wisdom of knowledge of good and evil and yet child? And I think that's what you're describing when you talk about experiencing that thing again for the first time with wonder and awe. One day I was driving, I'm just practicing this meditation, this gratitude meditation, right? And it starts in your head kind of like as an exercise. Like, I'm thankful for my car. I'm thankful for my wife. I'm thankful for my kids. I'm thankful for the mountains, you know. And I'm going through this. And the more you go through it, it starts to sink into your heart, right? And it started sinking into my heart. And I started really feeling it, feeling the gratitude. And I said, you know, at one point I said, you know, God, thank you for grapes. I really love grapes. You didn't have to give us grapes. And I'm having this conversation with, as I'm driving, you know, you didn't have to give us grapes. They're just like little packets of juice. And they're like candy that just grows out of the ground. And I'm just going on and on about it. Because if you hadn't given it to us, I wouldn't have missed it. Like, I like oatmeal. And if just like my dog, if I didn't have anything else, the dog food would be fine. So I said, why? Question. It went from gratitude to asking, instead of like, why am I suffering? Like we usually ask, I asked, why did you give us grapes? Why did you do that? You didn't have to do it. Why'd you do it? And the response I got, the feeling was this feeling of excitement, which really puzzled me because I didn't expect that God would be excited. He knows everything. So why would a question I have excite him? And this is where I started to really see God as a father and a teacher, where like when I'm teaching and a student's like asking me a question about the subject, I'm like, yes, yes. Now we can have a big boy conversation, right? And so I felt that excitement. And the answer that came to me, that came to my mind and my heart was, again, totally unexpected. I would expect God to say, I made grapes because I love you. Or I would expect him to say, I made grapes so that because I'm creative, right? I'm an artist.
I said, so we can have this conversation.
Oh my gosh, yes, you are totally understood. That's exactly what came to my mind and heart. Yes. Yes, he said, so you would ask that question. I gave you grapes so you would ask that question. Yeah. And then I started to understand, oh, everything in this world is pointing to me and it's lifting your mind so that you can speak my language. And then once you can speak my language, we can talk. And that's what brings me joy, is talking to you. Yes. That's what I want to do.
150% yes.
Isn't that amazing?
150%. When I am in awe and wonder and astonishment, I am literally worshiping. I am on my knees and lifted up at the exact same moment to be with something so much bigger than I am. I become so small and so big at the same time. Everything stops. That is bliss. We can find it in anything. The pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. If you focus on the silver lining, and you control your mind and your behavior, your heart lines up. It does. I've challenged it. I've tested this hypothesis. I'm a tester. I'm a rebel.
I'm really interested in this concept of awe, this kind of ecstatic rapture, you know, it's as a sort of antidote to existential despair, you know. Awe hints at something greater than ourselves. As Tom Robbins says, it forces you to gawk in amazement at the ubiquitous everyday wonders you're culturally disposed to ignore. They take the mind's attention away from the lethargy of custom. You know, there was a recent article that I read about the Hubble Space Telescope written by Ross Anderson, where he talks about what the Hubble has given us. And he said that it's given us nothing less than an ontological awakening, a forceful reckoning with what is, allowing us to contemplate space and time on a scale just shy of the infinite. And then he talks about the deep field photograph. And he says, gazing upon the deep field is like mainlining the whole of time through the optic nerve, okay? So you talk about awe as like a sense of like salvation or a sense of transcendence that it gives you is like, The idea of mainlining the whole of time through the optic nerve, something so vast, something so grand through something so small, is a testament to who we are. You know, as Sophocles says, manifold the wonders, nothing towers more wondrous than man. And I think that's what I mean when I say awe. It allows us to celebrate ourselves a little bit more.
That was Jason Silva. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about him after break. I got to introduce you to an incredible human being. This is Jason Silva, and it's as close as someone comes to being my guru, I guess.
Stanford and Berkeley and other places did these studies on the subject of awe. Awe is an experience described as one of such perceptual vastness, right? Such perceptual expansion that the mental models of the world that you usually rely upon to categorize things as happening to you. It's the been there's and done that's of the adult mind. It's like, oh yeah, that's a light. Oh yeah, that's a person. Yeah, I've seen those kinds of shirts before. Oh yeah, it's just another sunset, right? But occasionally you encounter something that's not in your maps as of now. Those maps you've built throughout your life to categorize and put things into order, you encounter something that doesn't fit into those maps. And it can be something that's genuinely outside those maps, or you can be in an altered state of consciousness that makes you see something that was already in the maps, but you're seeing it from a vastly different vantage point. Either or.
Yep.
But the point is that during those experiences, you have to now accommodate yourself, enter into a new relationship with this thing. And in that act, right, he calls it the dialectical pattern of reconcilable estrangement. This is David Lenson. Google it. But it's creating, you know, the experience offers a distance between this thing and you, and then your new relationship with it closes that distance. And that act we experience subjectively as awe. This particular rhapsody, this awe-inspiring, paralyzing, opiated adjacency where you're cracked open and the light gets in, like Leonard Cohen says, right? Like these moments of awe, I mean, they're awesome, right? That, duh.
If you're attracted to Jason Silva's ideas and energy like I am, do yourself a favor. After this episode, go to YouTube and search Shots of Awe, because they're short little shots of philosophical espresso. Oh, and if there's some way that you could get me in touch with him, 6 degrees of separation and all, well, suffice to say, you will immediately become my hero.
But they're not just pleasurable in that moment, but like I said before, they heal us, because after the fact, the studies found, people report increased feelings of well-being, increased feelings of compassion, increased feelings of creativity, those three. Oh, and the experience acts as an anti-inflammatory. So it has all these like markers in your body that essentially it's good for you. These studies about awe were in Berkeley and Stanford, but then the studies that are coming out now treating people with PTSD, anxiety, and depression with psychedelics, the stuff from Johns Hopkins University and the Imperial College of London that Michael Pollan wrote about, these studies say that the healing takes place only when people experience a mystical experience while under these molecules. And if you look at the hallmarks, if you fill the questionnaire, the William James questionnaire of a mystical experience, all of the attributes mimic or mirror the experience of awe that I was just talking about before. A feeling of the sacred, a feeling of communion with the cosmos, a feelings of infinite connection with other human beings, a feeling of well-being, a feeling of noetic truth, of ultimate reality being revealed, right? So mystical experiences mediated by psychedelics, treating people who are sick from depression and anxiety to treatment resistance, right? The more mystical the experience, the more they report the healing weeks and months afterwards. Same with people who experience awe that doesn't necessarily have to be mediated by psychedelics. It can be the birth of a child. It can be seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time. It can see making love to somebody new. It can be traveling.
Yep.
The whole point is that we need to pay more attention to what happens to us that is so healing during these moments that are so economically non-useful.
So I've been watching a lot of Jason Silva lately to boost my juice, you know, my creative umph to increase my desire and my energy and my intentions, to motivate me to make and create and connect instead of spend and consume and replace, to engage in activities that can lead to awe, to wake me up and follow my bliss. I gotta tell you, during this pandemic-induced quarantine, I have hit some pretty intense walls of utter agitated boredom. But it turned to ennui-inspired motivation because I allowed wonder to fill the space. And that's what provoked this podcasting adventure that's been so ridiculously rewarding to me, and to you too, I hope. In our society, everyone and everything is vying for our attention, to get our time and our money, and we fill that empty space. We fill in the pauses, we pack them to the brim, and leave no room for any magic around us. I mean, we're adults. We've got work to do, families to feed, homes to clean, places to get to. We have responsibilities, an onslaught of responsibilities. So if we do see some magic, we write it off as sleight of hand. We know the trick. And we move ahead into our normal routine. We start our day by grabbing our phone before our eyes are even fully open, because we need to fill that space, that pause. We're always doing. And while we're doing, we're thinking about what we need to do next and when we should stop what we're doing now so that we can get to that next thing. And when we do wonder, it's usually about whether or not they did that thing that has to be done so that I can do my next thing. I mean, our culture breeds professional boredom busters and consummate vacuum fillers, you know? Lest you really pause and step through the matrix and stop feeding the machine. Go, 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 spend, produce, do, waste, replace, consume. But how about create? Imagine. Explore. I can tell you as a mom, I remember the day that I realized how much my kids' mental and emotional growth required a certain amount of ennui, of boredom. They just had to hit these moments when they had nothing at all to do, nowhere to be, so that they'd hit that wall of boredom. Because unless they were forced to linger there in that space that feels so awkward, if they didn't sit there, might not turn to wonder and indulge the utterly unnecessary and yet ideally important muscle of curiosity. With no need for a final answer, not a correct one, not any answer, there's no need for an end to the quest at all. To be so bored that your mind fills in the empty space, pushes you off the cliff into a land of spontaneous, frivolous, mental and physical exploration. Think about your last mental journey. Mine have mostly happened when I'm stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic on the 10 from downtown to the ocean at rush hour. But that's only if I can push back the frustration. If frustration finds its way in to fill that void of boredom, nope, no wonder. But if not, it could be that shy little stepchild of my 5 regular senses might venture out to explore. And if I allow her to, intuition may even decide to play. And when she gets playing, amazing things happen. And though the experience of wonder and awe is fleeting, the residual side effects are lasting. In the lives of most adults, I'll bet every single person affected by the family disease of any addiction, there's not a lot of time for true boredom. We're just too busy. And when we could wonder, we worry, leaving us feeling awful instead of awe-filled. One of the neatest things that I've learned in all of this studying of awe for this show is that it can increase our tolerance while decreasing how we experience conflict in the negative. I mean, conflict is required in order for us to grow. Discomfort is our growth zone. Comfort and familiarity breeds contempt. So we don't want to stagnate, and therefore we do need conflict. But if we use awe to shrink ourselves and connect to others, we can turn conflict into questions and approach conversations looking for understanding instead of trying to persuade the other. There's a phenomenal TED Talk by this guy, Bo Lato. It's called How We Experience Awe and Why It Matters. And besides having this exhilarating performance by Cirque du Soleil and some live sand light painter, you've got to see it. He also explains the research that he and his group have been doing using art and the shared experience of awe in order to increase tolerance in humans. The other thing he explains is that awe gives us courage and encourages us to take risks, to step into the unknown without fear, but with wonder and curiosity. So, basically, it all comes full circle. I began this episode explaining that as a child, I was so uncertain and fearful about my life's uncertainty that I had to grow up too quickly to indulge in childlike wonder and awe. And now, as an adult, finally taking time to nurture and foster those feelings and states of mind, I've learned that the more I wonder, the more I feel awe, the less I feel stressful, the more I experience life, the more courageous I am, the kinder and more connected I become, and it in turn drives out that fear and uncertainty. So in some way, isn't awe a form of worship for a creator who's made us creative? I also think it's the antithesis of fear and anger, and maybe even a solution for the degrading qualities of conflict. But there's one problem. If awe leads to connection with others, especially human beings, and those connections could lead to intimacy of any kind, I know myself. I have attachment issues. Whether it's difficulty in trust, or fear of commitment, or the inevitable enmeshed entanglement of my emotions, my history in relationships, from romantic to professional, has always been a crazy game of dichotomies, either too much or too little. My dial goes from 0 to 10 so quickly, I think it might be a switch. However, I do believe there is a solution, a third option. I believe I've actually found a way of connecting with others and can finally accept, trust, and enjoy those connections to the point where I feel a true sense of belonging. Me, the terminally unique one, the eternal misfit, belonging, a part of. It's true. So what is the secret to a codependent, adult child nutjob like me experiencing intimacy, but in a rewarding and safe and healthy way? My answer, my solution, the key to this kind of connection, belonging, love, and intimacy is boundaries. And that is where we will go for our final episode of Unboxing God. We're going to talk about boundaries, love, and intimacy with ourselves, with others, and with Waldo. I hope to see you then. Bye.
The idea of mainlining the whole of time through the optic nerve, something so vast, something so grand through something so small, is a testament to who we are.